You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Okay, I'm recording again.
I'm recording too.
There, you see him, take three. Sitting very close the way. His hair looks a little crazy, but there's something about him.
This is this close to being offensive. That was Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Dan and I were just singing poorly. And
classic.
That's what we're doing. What a way to start. Another week. This week we are, I guess we're veering a little bit, but we're really trying to focus in on things that, frankly, things we love and things that you can see right now. So we are talking about the documentary Howard,
which you can watch right now on Disney Plus.
You can watch it. We watched it last night and I'm not crying. You're crying.
Here's the log line. He gave a mermaid her voice and a beast his soul.
So an actor is saying his lines and then out of nowhere, he just starts singing.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Jimmy, don't cry for me.
Howard is about Howard Ashman, the lyricist of such Disney classics as Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, and The Little Shop of Horrors. This is a documentary featuring never-before-seen archival footage, personal films, and photographs, as well as interviews with Howard's friends and family. The film is an intimate look into the Disney legend's life, his creative drive, and the process behind the music. Spanning from his childhood home in Baltimore to his formative years in New York, Howard goes in-depth to explore his journey to become the lyricist behind some of the most beloved and well-known classic family films in the world. He wrote the words to our childhood. Let's just call it what it is.
I found a way to tie it into last week so that we have a good transition. I know you love transitions.
I'm a big fan of
transitions. Appealing to your senses. And yes, also, exactly. I'm sorry to everyone listening that we don't have a guest this week, but I'm also
because we're going to nerd out about the guy who wrote such lyrics as Certain as the Sun Rising in the East, Beauty and the Beast. The only reason that I know that the sun rises in the east is because of the lyric to that song.
We won't talk about the public school system in Michigan. That's for another day. So I don't know if you caught this, but there's a segment where he's bragging about how many people were interested in Little Shop. And he says that they settled on the Schuberts, David Geffen, and Cameron McIntosh, the original producer of Little Shop off Broadway at the Orpheum Theater in New York City.
Who produced Phantom of the Opera.
That's right.
Well done, Dan. You're a real podcaster now.
That's right.
Just in case.
I'm a journalist.
You're a journalist. That's amazing. That's amazing. This was such a remarkable documentary. And I think that a lot of people, frankly, don't really know. They know Beauty and the Beast. They know Aladdin. They know this Disney renaissance that happened in the early, late 80s, early 90s that we'll talk about. But Howard Ashman is a name that if you don't know, he has certainly touched your life and your history with musical theater, because the best musical theater in the early 90s was Disney movies.
The revival of Broadway started in cartoon form.
Exactly. So we'll get into all of this, but this was a remarkable story and something that it'll make you cry. It'll make you, laugh and think. It is such a celebration of everything we love about Broadway, and you can check it out right now, which is all we're trying to do in this, in this time.
We should, while you're at it, he wrote, we can watch Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, and Little Mermaid. I wish I had time to do that this week and watch all those again, because...
Shop of Horrors,
the movie.
You can see all of that stuff. And Alex was saying, we were watching it last night and she was like, we have to watch all of these movies now. Now we're just going to do a Disney week.
Deep dive.
And it's fun, but it's also kind of a fun sort of bridge because last week or 2 weeks ago, we watched Robin Hood, the original, the Robin Hood from the 70s. Little John and Robin Hood walking through the forest.
Robin Hood and Little John walking through the forest, laughing back and forth at what the other has to say.
Right. One of my favorites from my childhood. Like I had that on a loop when I was when I was a kid. And then there was this gap in sort of Disney animation history from like the sort of middle,
late
you know,
60s,
like
right?
late 60s. That was 1971, I believe, when Robin Hood came out. And then like, you know, the sort of mid 70s into the 80s where there was basically nothing. They talk about in the documentary how Disney animation was moved off the Disney campus to a bunch of trailers. And that is where this Disney Renaissance started again with, and we'll get into it, Little Mermaid. So
technically
it was cool.
With Oliver and Company and the Great Detective and Amblin Media, Amblin Entertainment, which is Steven Spielberg's company, was the kind of the beginning. And then what secured it was Howard and Alan Menken.
Which is super, super cool. And like this, anyway, so we'll get into it.
We'll get into it. And I'm going to run through some of this history. A lot of this, I'm going to really, because I did a lot of this research before I watched the documentary. So I'm going to try and go fast through all this stuff and only cover the things that aren't in the documentary.
Love it.
Kind of add a little bit more texture to this guy's life. So obviously the beginning of the film covers his Howard's childhood and going to college, and he eventually goes to grad school at Indiana University. And when he leaves Indiana University, he comes to New York and he founds the iconic off-Broadway theater, the WPA. And that he did for a few years, and that's where he wrote his first musical with Alan Menken called God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which is a Kurt Vonnegut book that they adapted. And then they transferred that off Broadway. And that was when he started to really kind of catch steam in the community in New York. But he met Alan Menken at BMI Workshop, and his classmate was Maury Yeston, just sensible. Maury Yeston wrote Nine and Lacage and Grand Hotel and Titanic. BMI Workshop, for those of you who don't know, it's a composer and lyricist workshop where you go for 3 years and you participate with other composer lyricists. And a lot of iconic groups have gotten together working in this workshop, like Aaronson Flaherty, who wrote Ragtime and Anastasia, Tom Kitt and Brian Yorkey, who actually wrote Next to Normal at the BMI workshop as part of their third-year presentation. Andrew Lippa went there, Go Blue. He wrote Wild Party and Big Fish. Bobby and Kristen Lopez went to BMI of Avenue Q and Frozen. And Janine Tesori, who wrote Fun Home and Carolina Change and Thoroughly Modern Millie, she also went to BMI. So that was kind of where they got their, where their relationship originated. And that was kind of one of the foundations of how they knew to write the way that they did. But their first real like commercial success was Little Shop of Horrors in 1982. Howard was the director, librettist, and lyricist. It ran off-Broadway for 5 years. It's the third longest running off-Broadway show, and it's the highest grossing off-Broadway show of all time. He won the Drama Desk Award for Best Music, the Drama Critics Circle for Best Musical, and there's a lot of other stuff I have in here that we can talk about with Little Shop, because there's a lot of really interesting details about why they chose to do the show the way that they did, and I think there's a lot of cool history there.
Just back to God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. They did just revive. It didn't run for very long when it first opened off Broadway, you know, 1979, and they transferred it. But they did it off Broadway, off center, Encores off center in 2016 with Santino Fontana and Bryn O'Malley, James Earl Jones. And there is a cast recording of that. So like there's a lot of great music in there that like people don't really know. And so if you want to explore a cast album and like, you know, just kind of impress your friends, like, oh, do you know like what Alan Menken and Howard Ashman's first show was? Because like it was actually this one. It's a wonderful there's a lot of great music in there. And you know, this cast album, it was directed by Michael Mayer at Encores Off Center, and there's a cast album. So
oh, sick. It was awesome. I saw they played some clips from that, and I was curious what production that was. So after the success of Little Shop of Horrors, Howard directs and writes the book and lyrics for a show called Smile, based on a movie with Marvin Hamlisch, who was the
PGOT winning.
This is wild.
So, yeah. Because you put that in our notes that like it is crazy, and they talk about it in the documentary that Marvin Hamlisch obviously wrote Chorus Line, along with other things, but like he was one of the heaviest hitters.
He was Lin-Manuel.
He was the guy, and you know, this was the first kind of, I guess, collaboration outside. It felt like the first collaboration that Howard had outside of Alan Menken, and it was like going to be his ticket to Broadway. It was going to be his like Broadway, you know, kind of the Broadway, I don't know, entrance to the club, if you will.
Exactly.
And then it just like totally, I mean, failed. I hate saying failed, but it runs for 48 performances.
Right.
You know, but it was not successful.
A quote lost musical because it doesn't have a cast recording. But I've definitely heard girls sing from
Neverland. A lot of people at Michigan in college did Neverland Disneyland.
Disneyland.
Yeah. Which is kind of a famous song from it. So there is some stuff that you find, but I thought that this was kind of cool.
Yeah.
That Jodie Benson played the lead in Smile. And after, I mean, they talk about this in the documentary as well, but after Smile didn't turn out as everybody hoped, that Howard gave her the chance to audition for the voice of Ariel. And she talks about that in the documentary, like, you never know how things are going to go, basically. That, you know, what a gift.
Yeah, totally. And piggybacking off of that, I think the most striking thing about, so he has this show that completely fails. And then he literally runs away from New York, is the way it was described by Don Hahn Triumphant. Didn't think I was not going to get that in there. Don Hahn was the producer of Beauty and the Beast, and he produced The Hunchback, and he's the director of this movie. And he talks about Howard fleeing to Los Angeles because he was so humiliated and felt like he didn't want to expose himself to Broadway again, because he felt like his self was identified in his work. And so he flees New York after this terrible thing happens to him, and then he changes the world.
Yeah, right.
You know what
I mean?
Like, it's such a good reminder. It was so inspiring to me because I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, there's no really such thing as failure. There's just like the next thing that you can do, because hindsight's 20/20. And when you look back, it's like, thank God Smile failed.
Right. Because if Smile doesn't fail, who knows if he just, you know, I'm sure we would have all of these musicals that he would have written in New York. It would have been fine. You know, like,
could have been fine.
This other path would have been amazing too. But the idea that we get The Little Mermaid and Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast because of the failure of Smile. I think that's a very interesting, that Sound of Music quote, you know, where God closes a door somewhere, he opens a window. It's like, he opens this window in LA, you know, and everything changes.
It's
cool. Yeah.
He moves to Los Angeles and he writes the lyrics for a song in the movie called Oliver and Company, which is a animal representation of the Oliver story.
Ah.
And there's some iconic people in it. Joey Lawrence plays Oliver Twist, and Billy Joel plays the Artful Dodger.
Wait a minute.
Yes, dude.
Wait a minute.
Yes. Bette Midler's in it.
Stephanie Stiles
would be mad at you, dude. This is like a huge bit of Disney history that is worth checking out.
Honestly, I missed this completely. With the Oliver and Company. I'm just looking it up right now. Wow, yeah.
So while he's working on this, he hears about The Little Mermaid. Howard hears about Little Mermaid, and he kind of dives into The Little Mermaid. And it was the first fairy tale that they'd done in 30 years. And he wrote all the songs for the film. And he talks about how they said, who do you want to bring in to write the music? And he said, I want Alan Menken. So that secures their relationship with Disney. And they make this little known story called The Little Mermaid. It was released in 1989 and it was a huge success. They received 2 Golden Globe nominations and 3 Academy Award nominations, including 2 for Kiss the Girl and Under the Sea. They win the Academy Award for Under the Sea. Then in 1988, while he's working on The Little Mermaid, Howard pitches an idea for Aladdin. And
which is so cool in the movie to like watch, because he play. I mean, Aladdin is this sort of ancient, almost ancient tale, you know, fairy tale and whatever, and that he played Aladdin in one of the adaptations of the play in college, and he comes in, and that was one of the coolest things to see, like the deck that he created, the treatment. I mean, you and I are working on treatments all the time, that like he came in
30
with three
page
songs.
Treatment.
He came in with this 30 page treatment and three songs, Arabian Nights, Arabian Nights, friend like me,
and Prince Ali,
and was like, could you imagine being in the room and having Howard Ashman come in with that treatment and be like, okay, so listen to this. Like Alan Menken talks about in the film, like seeing a Howard Ashman lyric in front of him for the first time. And as a composer, like what that meant to him. And we'll talk about our relationship, because we have a relationship with Alan Menken that's kind of cool. Some stories about him, but we'll get to that later. But that Aladdin story, you know, that was really, really, really remarkable, and really kind of what his fingerprint is all over all of these movies. But he sort of almost served as lyricist, book writer, director, star, you know, he kind of had like his hand on every part of these movies.
Yeah. He was so story obsessed. It seemed like he needed to make sure that the story was being told in every single moment. So he couldn't help himself but to involve himself in the music and the way way the actresses were singing and the way that characters were drawn and all of that kind of stuff, which is such a good reminder and is an awesome story. So they're working on Aladdin, and they get approached to try and help Beauty and the Beast, which was floundering apparently during production. And at this point, he's learned that he's sick and has HIV at the time. That kind of starts this downward trajectory of his health, which later starts to affect how these productions function. And you can see a lot more detail about that in the film, but it's really hard to watch. You just feel so bad for this guy who had so much potential and so much life, and you just see that gets sapped, you know, out of
it. I think that it's worth mentioning, and I was going to mention this later, but I think it's as good a time as any to say, like, to remind people, and we're young guys ish you know, and it's 2020 and there's a pandemic, but there was an epidemic in the 80s and 90s that took an entire generation of musical theater performers, writers, composers, directors, people who I feel like we all have to remember, like, the world that could have been if Howard Ashman was still here, if this generation was not lost to the AIDS epidemic. And I think in that time, you know, we'll get to this too, when he won the Academy Award posthumously for Beauty and the Beast, that his partner got up and said so eloquently,
"In working on Beauty and the Beast, Howard faced incredible personal challenges, but always gave his best. And what made that possible was an atmosphere of understanding, love, and support. That's something everyone facing AIDS not only needs, but deserves. There's an inscription at Howard's grave in Baltimore. It reads, 'Oh, that he had one more song to sing.' We'll never hear that song, but I'm deeply grateful for this tribute you've given to what he left behind. For Howard, I thank you."
Basically just encompassed the everything that one could want to hear about this fight with AIDS, you know, in a very public way.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Joe. So Beauty and the Beast comes out after a few months after Howard passes, and it wins the Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture. And it became the first animated film to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. It won the Academy Award for Best Original Score and Best Original Song, and which Joe just mentioned, and it received nominations for Best Sound.
Yeah.
In 1990. Go ahead.
No. You were just going to say it, that in 94, it was adapted to a Broadway musical.
Right. Iconic cast album.
Yo, Terrence Mann.
Dude.
Listen to it over and over and over again. And I have this joke in here that it's the musical that made me want to be an actor professionally, because we did it we did it my sophomore year of high school. We were one of the first high schools to do it, like in Michigan or whatever. And still, if I go back to Grand Rapids or East Grand Rapids, people will still bring that up as the best thing I've ever done. Do you remember when you were the Beast, Beauty and the Beast? So my sophomore year of high school, and I was like, yeah, well, I peaked. I peaked at 16. So I just remember, man, like it was the best. It was the best. And I am so, it's very funny to relive, but it was the greatest. It was the greatest show. It's the greatest show I've ever done. That's it. I should have quit after that.
I had the same experience with another show that we'll talk about on here in a couple weeks.
Great.
So the last show that Howard had his hand in was Aladdin, which came out in 1992. The process of that show was a bit tumultuous. This 30-page treatment that Howard built with Alan was kind of thrown away. And out of the 16 songs that he wrote for Aladdin, only three of them survive. And then one of them was put back into the show when the Broadway production came out, which is Proud of Your Boy. And yeah, we have a story about Alan Menken. And what opened my eyes to this story and this man was this time that Alan Menken came and did a workshop at school. And when he started talking about Howard, do you remember him crying?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was brutal. He couldn't get it out. It was one of the coolest days ever. Alan Menken, we went to school with Nora Menken, Alan's daughter. And Nora was a year older than us. Her senior year, Alan Menken came and did a masterclass. And that masterclass included, among other things, our friend Will Burton, friend of the podcast, getting up and singing Proud of Your Boy in front of him. And Proud of Your Boy is a song that obviously was put back into the Broadway version of Aladdin. And it was a song that was one of Howard's favorite lyrics that he had ever written because it was unbelievably personal. Proud of your boy, I'll make you proud of your boy, mom, you know, as bad as I've been, mom, all of these things, that it was incredibly personal. It was incredibly personal to Howard. And he was, you know, it was devastating that it didn't make it into the movie, but then they were able to put it back into the show. It became this musical theater phenomenon where a lot of people were singing it as an audition song before Aladdin came to the stage officially. So we knew a little bit about it, and it was the coolest thing ever. So Will Burton gets up and he has his binder of music, and he's in, they're talking about the history of, you know, Howard's history and Aladdin and the whole thing. And Will goes to put the music in front of Alan Menken to play it at the piano. Alan Menken's going to play it at the piano for Will, and Will is going to perform it in front of the entire,
school program.
Basically program. And he goes to put the music, and I have chills. He goes to put the music in front of Alan, and Alan looks at him and he goes, I don't need that. And he just looks up, and Alan Menken is watching Will the whole time. He never looks down at the keys. He never looks anywhere else. And he just watches Will sing this song and play the music, you know, with no music in front of him. It was one of the coolest things. And everybody's crying. I don't care who you are. Like, right, everybody was a mess during this time.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And then that was a sort of a very emotional moment. The next thing that he did is he plays, Alan Menken sits at the piano and plays a mashup of basically every song he's ever written at the piano, from Beauty and the Beast to Hercules to, you know, all the Aladdin songs and just everything. So that, and that was like this 12-minute medley of all of his greatest hits. It was one of the coolest days ever. I might still have a recording of that on my phone.
I definitely do.
They work all day out in the sun to slave away while we devoting full time to floating under the sea. Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything?
Great.
So awards and considerations and critical response. Obviously, we've talked about awards. They've won a bunch of awards for their shows, but I thought some of these things were cool. Little Mermaid has a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes and an 88 Metacritic score. Beauty and the Beast has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes with a 95 critic score and an A+ cinema score. And Aladdin has a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, an 86 Metacritic score, and an A+ cinema score. So these movies have obviously stood the test of time. They built our childhoods and our love for Broadway. And that leads us into Impact.
Yeah, seriously. So we talked about the Disney Renaissance earlier, but the 80s were a dark time for Disney animation. You know, coming off the classics of, like I said, Robin Hood and Pinocchio, which they're making a remake of, that's coming up. And then, you know, even back to Sleeping Beauty. And so this Renaissance that we call it was sort of, you know, the period between 89 and 1990, you know, where 1989 and 1999, where it was just like all the movies, you know, from Little Mermaid to you know, Hercules and beyond. I mean, it was just like that decade of just like, you know, perfect Broadway animated movies, basically, you know, animated movies through Broadway. I love this.
Concludes that, yeah, with like Tarzan.
Yeah, right. Which was still,
Tarzan's like the cap. Yep. Also love Tarzan.
Don't care who you are. Love Tarzan. Love Tarzan. Yeah. You know, so I think that one of the things about this, the impact of this that I think is huge is, like, again, like we talk about Disney, the Disney animated movie of that time brought Broadway kind of back to life. I mean, in the same way too. I mean,
yeah, there was a cool thing in there where Howard was talking about how the final frontier of the Broadway musical is in animation.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that, just for those of you who don't know, I'm not sure if we've ever covered this on the podcast before, but anybody who was in New York in the 70s and 80s knew that Times Square was not a great place to be. And with Disney opening Beauty and the Beast on Broadway in 1994, it began the renaissance of Times Square and the Disneyfication of Broadway, and the revitalization of the center part of New York City was built on the back of Howard Ashman and Alan Menken's musicals. Like, we do not have the industry and this beautiful tourist attraction that we have now without those guys.
Is it beautiful?
And without these stories. Well, yeah, that was an interesting word choice,
honestly,
I would say.
But like,
I'm not sure.
But like, beautiful now, like all I want to do is like walk through the you know, bright lights and you know, headache that is Times Square.
Probably better than it was when people were...
No, totally. And it was just this thing that, like, you know, they... Yeah. You know, Disney and said at the time, like, or if we're going to bring family musicals to Times Square, we have to know that Times Square is not going to be the cesspool that it was. And they completely, yeah, you know, revitalized it, you know, kind of. That was a very controversial thing back in sort of like the age of, you know, Giuliani as mayor, where like there was a lot of stuff going on, yeah, in New York, but it was like, here comes Disney and we're going to bring, you know, we're going to revitalize Times Square. And that happened with Beauty and the Beast.
Not to be political about anything, yeah, there, but this, yeah, it's just was, an interesting, yeah, piece of history of what the impact of all of this was. And then there, the impact of like kind of the, they basically, in my opinion, like taught a generation about story song, about, yeah, the idea that musicals are not just fluff. Musicals are not just, okay, the story's going and now we stop and we sing a song. They really are simple.
Yep.
They rhyme perfectly, obviously, but mostly they're pushing the story. And the story is changing and the character starts in one place and finishes in the other. And it's really...
Yeah, and it takes... A lot of writers say it takes an unbelievable amount of craft to make something seem easy. You know, like, yeah, it may sound easy to write, you know, tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, but you didn't write it and you couldn't, you know, like, so
yeah.
I think that's kind of the fun part too, to be like, it's so masterful because it is so complicated. And then we'll get into this now, like, because we're going to get to the music section because it's so,
yeah,
this is the most important part of all of this, you know, for us and for him. But like, then he goes and rhymes a million different things, but like, one of my, we're going to talk about this later, but like, he rhymes Shaw with baklava in,
right,
Friend Like Me.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. It's just, he was just a genius. He was just an absolute genius.
Totally.
So let's get into, we'll get into the music. This is the best part.
We're going to talk now in a new segment called Craft, kind of the craft of these composers and what they were doing. And there's a really awesome segment in the film where Howard's talking about Poor Unfortunate Souls. And like, Poor Unfortunate Souls is a great song because we all remember kind of the iconic behavioral, you know, mood of Ursula. But also when you look at the song on the page, like Ariel doesn't know who Ursula is. And by the end of the song, she's a human.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot going on in this thing that's like, you know, seemingly simple.
Yeah, exactly. And all of these, I mean, Kiss the Girl, another one, brings us right to the edge of where, like, she's going to become a human and reclaim her voice. And, you know, like, oh my God.
It's almost a yes.
Almost a yes. It just, you know, it's so perfect. And then back to the very first song, the probably most iconic song in the movie, is Part of Your World. And it, first of all, it almost didn't even make it in the movie, which they talk about, which is insane now in retrospect. Yeah. There was one person, I forget who it is, but the one person was like, you know, I wanted to cut it and I didn't want it in the movie.
It was Jeffrey Katzenberg. It was the head of, he was a large job at Disney. I forget exactly what his title was. I guess it had not tested well. Like that's the story that was on Wikipedia, is
so
that
crazy.
They tested it in front of a bunch of kids, as they usually do test these movies, especially at Disney, in front of the audience that they are trying to sell it to.
Right.
And the kids were like really like rowdy.
Mm. Yeah.
And so they were like, well, we got to cut this song because it doesn't work for the kids. And Howard was like, absolutely not. We need an I Want song.
Yep.
You don't know what that is, but
I know what
we
that
need
is
it here.
Well, and that's what we want to get into, because like the master, he was such a purist when it came to musical theater. And it would like the idea of Eliza Doolittle and My Fair Lady, All I Want Is a Room Somewhere, you know, with chocolate for me to eat and, you know, a room with lots of heat. He wrote that with Somewhere That's Green. Somewhere That's Green in Little Shop of Horrors is that exact same model. That has happened in every musical that you've ever seen, whether you know it or not. The second song in every musical is the song where the person, whoever it is, stands up there and tells you exactly what they want, and then for the next 2.5 hours, they're going to be chasing it. From The Wizard and I to, you know, Orlando in the Book of Mormon, that's the model. So he said, no, children can handle this. Like, you know, part of your world is I want to be where the people are. I just want to be up where the people are, and I'm going to take you on this journey for the next 2 hours. And it's masterful. It's exactly, everybody's still doing it. It's exactly what musical theater is based on. Anyway, it was just so cool. So
I know Seymour's the greatest, but I'm dating a semi-sadist, so I got a black eye and my arms in a cast. Seymour's a cutie. Well, if not, he's got inner beauty. And I dream of a place where we could be together at last.
There was also, there's a cool thing in here where Alan Menken said that Howard changed his ability to write a song and changed his understanding of style. And he was talking about they weren't sure what direction to take the style of Little Shop.
Yeah.
And they settled on the dark side of Greece.
It's just awesome.
Right?
It's just awesome.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can hear that too. There's a clip we can play right here.
Shing-a-ling, shing, what a pretty thing to be happening. Look out, look out, look out, look out.
That girl group rock and roll thing,
the Ronettes,
which is so genius.
Idea. Yeah. It's just, it's so good. You have this thing in here too from the show, that the Little Shop commercial. It's just
that
is just.
Never before in the history of the American stage have you seen such high drama.
You don't meet nice boys when you live on Skid Row, Mr. Bushnick.
Suspense.
Little red dots all over the floor.
And romance. It's bone-chilling. It's spine-tingling. It's a musical. It's
a nifty laugh riot, entertaining as it is exotic. Little Shop of Horrors. Don't shop around. Go see it at the Westwood Playhouse.
1980s. What is this? At its absolute finest.
Did you also catch, speaking of Little Shop, did you catch that Jack Nicholson is in the original?
Yes.
Little Shop movie?
Like,
what?
What is he doing there? I'm obsessed with that.
Before The Shining.
Unbelievable. And like this thing that, you know, again, he says, you know, everybody was like, you're going to write a musical about Little Shop of Horrors? That movie sucked. You know, like, what are you doing? And so I just am so glad that Howard Ashman and people like him didn't listen to critics. You know, like they didn't listen, you know, they listened to the people that they wanted to listen to, and that internal clock, that internal compass was so, you know, strong, because otherwise Little Shop never gets made. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because even his agent, he's talking in the movie, they give his agent was like, this is a stupid idea. You know?
Right. But it's a testament to the understanding of, and Joe and I are, because we're writing together, we're focusing on this a lot now, but like when you have an understanding of the craft of something, you can tell any story you want, right? Like Little Shop is just an American musical comedy. It's not any, like, it's stretched to its limits. It's almost a parody of the musical comedy, but that's exactly what Book of Mormon is. Totally. There is no Book of Mormon without Little Shop. It's the same thing. Book of Mormon follows this exact formula of what Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote an American musical to be.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. So super duper cool. All right. So let's get to the fun. Let's get
songs we love.
The songs we love. This is our favorite. This I thought was very cool. Just for a second, I read this in Vanity Fair that and it's in the documentary as well. But Don Hahn said who directed the Howard documentary said that Kill the Beast, right, from Beating the Beast, was a metaphor for Ashman dealing with a debilitating disease of AIDS in an era when it was stigmatized, you know, and so there were so many of those underpinnings to the movie that people may not have seen. And this is something that, like, people maybe don't necessarily agree with, you know, people who are close to him, whatever. But I think that the idea, like, how could you not, as somebody who was dealing with AIDS at the height of the AIDS crisis, feeling, and he says in the movie that he didn't tell people for so long because he felt like he was going to get fired from writing lyrics for Disney movies, for writing lyrics for family movies, as this disease was stigmatized, you know, and politicized so horribly, that, like, how could you not feel like the beast in this, you know, how could you not feel like everybody's chasing you with pitchforks? And watching those clips with that in mind, I just could, you know, you get chills. And what the guy must have been going through is he was trying to just, all he wants to do is write a lyric and write a song, but how can you not infuse that with the part of you that is, you know, literally dying? I don't know. It's just, it was a lot. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's interesting when I was thinking about, we're reading this book, Save the Cat, all of the shows he chose are out of the bottle stories. They're all of these shows are somebody who wants another life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, you can say that's an accident, and we're not going to say that he was trying to put his own life on the stage. Like, I think that that's a controversial statement, but at least he understands this idea that that the hand he was dealt was not a fair one.
Right.
And perhaps he was trying to teach himself through his work that the life he has can be a good life, you know?
Yeah.
The Seaweed is Always Greener lyric, you know?
Yeah. totally. We're getting into, like, you know, the specifics of the songs and the stuff that we love. So we're talking the Goosebump Test.
Yeah.
If you even say the title of the word of the song Beauty and the Beast, I get chills. I don't even have to listen to it. I just have to think about the transition from when he's, like, getting all scrubbed up in the bath or whatever, and then he emerges.
Tale as old as time.
And that simple padded piano, and then we broke this down in college where it's a major triad going up the scale. Da 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 dum, ba da 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 dum. It's just like a major triad, tale as old as time. Get out of here. Yeah. So
because it's not just a lyric or a feeling. It's like the reason that the rhythm and that the chord progressions are chosen is all because of the moment that it's serving, and the lyric is serving that too. It's just, they were so good at that. You know, it's almost like the pinnacle of what Rodgers and Hammerstein were doing, taken in a contemporary context.
Exactly.
Like you can follow that thread. My Goosebump Test is there are two. One is the big swell at the end of Part of Your World.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Out of the sea, wish I could be, like, mm-hmm. after it swells to the crescendo, and then it's just like this quiet moment. Goosebumps right now just thinking about it.
Yep.
And also when the elephant crashes through the door in Prince Ali.
Totally.
You know, and totally. That swell too, they just got me with their swells.
Totally.
The dynamics of those just always push me.
In the document, we'll talk about motifs, favorite motifs. In the doc, in the documentary, there's this picture of a lyric that he wrote, or like not a lyric, but like something that he wrote on a note card. What is a beast and what is a man? And I thought the motif of that, back to what we were saying about his struggle with his health, that like the way the world would be viewing him and the way that they view another man, or the way, like, what is like that idea in all of the movies and all of his lyrics have to deal with this line between, you know, what is good and what is evil, and what is a beast and what is a man. I don't know. I thought that the sort of lyric motif of that was amazing. And then I just had this joke that he does talk a lot about the sun setting and the sun rising, you know, and I joked about it earlier that like the only reason, you know, you can't say, certain as the sun rising in the west, tale as old as time, right. Beauty and the best. No, the way that I know that the sun rises in the east is because of Beauty and the Beast.
It rhymes with Beast.
Because it rhymes with Beast.
That's amazing.
The main part of this, and honestly, like,
yeah,
you know, the reason we're here, our favorite lyrics, and I just, there's too many to count, and there's too many shows to count, you know, but I think the saddest part of this is thinking about the shows that could have been. And the lyrics that could have been. I think there's just such an air of that around everything about Howard is just like, God, what can you imagine if he had another 30 years?
I know.
And the shows that we'd have and the movies that we'd have. And
I know.
You know, so anyway, on a funny, happier note, I'm a couple of my favorites. What do they got? A lot of sand. We've got a hot crustacean band.
A hot crustacean band.
Also, everything about Les Poissons is hysterical, yeah. But the rhyme scheme of Les Poissons, hee hee hee, ha ha ha. Les Poissons, hee hee hee, ha ha ha. With a cleaver, I hack them in two. It gets me every time. And it's funny because it's just like the chef is not a bad guy, but the chef is a bad guy in the movie because there's a bunch of fish watching him. But like, if that guy's just like, he loves cooking fish, what's wrong with that? Well, it's bad if you are a fish, you know? So.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, what about you? I have a bunch here.
I mentioned it earlier, but the seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. The grass is always greener lyric.
Great.
And that consistent idea. Yeah. I mean, that's probably my motif, right?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, somewhere that's
this
green.
Idea that somewhere that's green. Even Aladdin has some of it, even though he hasn't written a lot of music like that. And like Belle in the opening of In Belle. There must be more than this provincial. You know, this idea we're longing for a life that is different from our own, that's better somewhere else.
Yeah.
But
I want adventure in the great white somewhere. Right. I want it more than
sing,
I can
Joe.
Tell. Yeah, you better sing too. We're singing on this freaking thing. God, that's awesome.
I've also always just loved Kiss the Girl.
Yeah.
As we discovered last week, I'm a sucker for the romantic lyrics. And like when that just like,
yeah,
when that groove comes in, you know.
Strings, winds, words. There you see her
a crusty way. She don't got a lot to say, but there's something about her. And you don't know why, but you're dying to try. You wanna kiss the girl.
Did you hear something?
Well, and the desperation of Sebastian, like,
right?
If you know what I mean, like, you did. I didn't even get really catch that until last night watching the documentary. Where like Sebastian, everybody needs them. They need this to happen, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so anyway, it's just fantastic. And it's so specific and so amazing. I think that the most replayed song is almost like, how do you pick? In a way, like. For me, it's probably Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. I think it's a perfect song. I think that Suddenly Seymour is also an amazing song that we broke down as a lyric exercise in college, which is so silly but really fun, that like suddenly is one of the most important words in musical theater. Because something was happening and then out of nowhere, something else happened. This version just kills me. This production they did in LA. But it's so good. So those are probably my two most replayed favorite lyrics.
Mine has got to be Friend Like Me. I was a big Aladdin guy.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that I didn't have more Howard Ashman songs in Aladdin. I would have loved to hear some of what those other tunes were, but things happen. Friend Like Me, Prince Ali. I was basically had Aladdin, Lion King, and Hercules on repeat when I was a kid.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
That was a big one. And Gaston would be my most replayed song from Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
I just enjoyed the rhyme scheme and the game of it. And the
One slick as Gaston, no one's quick as Gaston, no one's next as incredibly thick as Gaston, for there's no man in town half as manly. Perfect, a pure paragon. You can ask any Tom, Dick, or Stanley, and they'll tell you whose team they prefer to be on.
You know, I was just a guy who liked musicals. So like
exactly. And then
I couldn't latch myself into it's too predictable, but I couldn't latch myself into these like girl songs. Like, ugh, I want to listen to the guy songs.
Well, and you wanted to be roughly the size of a barge, you know, I'm
That's
sure.
Right.
Like you go through these you know, pockets of time where you're trying to, you know, put on weight and look like him and
Yeah. Exactly.
God, that's funny. That's really, really good. But I love what you said, the game of it too. Like that song is just it's a masterful, you know. It's a masterful game. It truly is. So we have a performances category, which I think is more about shows, but I just think that Robin Williams as the genie, rest in peace, is so iconic. And I wonder, this is the thing that I would, if I ever got to ask, you know, Alan Menken or somebody, I want to know who comes up with the voices that he came up with in Friend Like Me.
Mine is Jerry Orbach is Lumiere.
Yep.
Right?
Again, like, iconic, rest in peace.
We're sitting there watching last night, and Julie's like, oh, that guy, which is my favorite thing that we do when she recognizes somebody from something
else.
Oh,
it's that guy.
Oh, that guy. And I'm like, how do you know Jerry Orbach? Law and Order.
Duh.
Yeah, also, the original Billy Flynn. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
you know?
Right. Musical theater.
Icon.
He's an icon. He's a musical theater icon. Yeah, just so freaking cool. And that footage was just amazing.
So awesome.
And then I think, you know, for me, the aging of this, you know, what holds up the best, what holds up the worst. I mean, the movies still hold up. Every single movie They're still iconic. They're
clearly, you know, they keep making them over
exactly.
and over again.
I mean, yeah, exactly. They just, you know, was Aladdin the last one they did of, or was Beauty and the Beast the last one? You know,
it was Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin.
Crazy. And then I mean, the sad thing is just the worst is just, we all wish he was here. You know, like I wish that there was a, you know, I wish there were more shows. I wish that he had more time. And
yeah,
that's kind of the hardest part of the movie to watch. And then one of the things that I was reading a bunch of stuff, and there was this quote that I really loved, that Alan Menken, said about Howard. I guess the most important thing to know is if anybody has feelings that AIDS is God's punishment or something, then just look at the man and what he created and what it is in our lives and think about that. And then he's speaking of the way in which the AIDS crisis cut down a generation of creative men and women, Menken added, it would be great if Howard was alive. We could write a musical about all of that. So the idea that, yeah, that breaks my heart. Think of just the music that could have been, you know.
It crushes me because I think about like losing you.
Like that's what it is.
Like what would I do?
Yeah, like what would you do? Your best friend and collaborator.
And even more than best friend, like your artistic second half.
Yeah.
Like he talks about how Howard like rebuilt how he makes, like how could you go and make anything again? It's like, oh man, I just can't imagine what that was like for him.
Yeah.
And that's what aged the worst for me, is watching some of the footage of the way people treated gay people and people with HIV during this time. It's really disgusting to watch.
Right.
And I see a lot of resonance in the way that people are treating Black Lives Matter and the way that people are handling the pandemic. You know, it's like, we just see the country kind of live in these cycles, and it's easier to look back on them now knowing what you know, but it's also like, we got to see people for who they are first, you know, even the people, even the Beast, you know?
Yeah. Totally.
It's like, even the people that we don't love, you got to find what makes them human. And that's what he did in his work. And that's what we have to do as people.
Yeah.
And what aged the best is, like, I think he talked about how in the beginning of the documentary, he's talking about, oh, you know, I grew up on Rodgers and Hammerstein and My Fair Lady and whatever, and Three Penny Opera and these other shows that formed, and Godspell, you know, formed the off-Broadway movement. Like, I'm just a student of my generation, and he is the teacher of our generation.
Right. Right. Right.
And like, he introduced our generation to what a musical can be. And
totally.
And
because, you know,
literally changed Disney's trajectory from a company that was struggling to what it is today.
And like, you know that Pasek and Paul and Lin-Manuel Miranda and the Lopez's, they were watching these movies and they were learning how to structure story around Howard Ashman. And so I think
we should have had Benjer Justin come on here, because they wrote lyrics for the new Aladdin movie.
All right. Well, this was an idea you had to talk about this movie. Like we just talked about it, like, you know, a couple days ago, we made the decision to talk about it. And I was like, maybe there's a world where we could send Alan Menken an email and he would talk to us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we got to meet him, you know, a few times, and maybe Benj and Justin would come on and nerd out about like what, you know, what Howard.
Benj would definitely come on.
Yeah.
So we should do that. What? Hey, audience.
Hey.
Send me a DM. What show should we talk to Benj Pasek about? Don't say Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah. Exactly. But that this was... so again, we highly, highly, highly recommend this documentary. Check it out. Watch all the Disney movies. And, you know, celebrate the life of Howard Ashman with us this week. And then...
what do you think, Joe? More Disney next week?
I honestly might want to.
Like Hercules, maybe?
Bless my soul. Hercules on a roll.
I think we could get her to come on.
Let's talk about it. Next week. On Guys,
on
who,
guys who Like Musicals.
Thanks for listening.
Go on, unfold your man. You take a glass and then you'll be our guest. We are guests. Be our guest. I'm already over 5 minutes, aren't I? Tale as old as time.
it can be. Barely even friends, then somebody bends unexpectedly. Just a little change, small to say the least. Both a little scared, neither one prepared. Beauty and the Beast.
Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are produced by Dan Tracy and Joe Carroll, your hosts. You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals or on Twitter at Musical Guys. For more information about us or our show, please visit our new website at guyswholikemusicals.com. You can find our merch store, our Patreon page, and more. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.